Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Nikazi Oates, the host of the channel. Joining me today is Maisha Cherry, the author of Failures of Forgiveness, What We Get Wrong and How to Do Better. She is an associate professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside. Maisha, welcome to New Books.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited for our conversation today. But before we dive in, I want to talk a little bit about you. You have written books on emotion.
Yes.
Have co-edited The Moral Psychology of Anger. You have written The Case for Rage. You even direct the Emotion and Society Lab at UC Riverside. What motivated you to study emotion and to do it in the field of philosophy?
Well, in some ways, I mean, the most simple way to answer the question is there are certain topics that we're drawn to as academics. And sometimes people are drawn to topics because they think that's the topic that's in vogue or that's the topic that's going to get them a job. But then there's just some topics that just call you, that excites you. Mm-hmm. And so I really can't explain what was it about emotions that really motivated me. So that's like the simple way to answer the question. But also I just recognize that emotions is something that all of us feel, all of us have experience with. Mm-hmm. And when I began to just study the emotions, it wasn't just from a kind of psychological perspective, but it was kind of looking at emotions in the context of the real world, the social world. And so I was becoming fascinated with not just that we have these feelings, but there are certain ways in which these feelings are interpreted depending on certain social contexts, whether that is your race, whether that's your gender. There's certain ways in which these emotions can be used to control others, to silence others. So I was very fascinated, not just about the experience per se, or what we typically learn about emotions from a psychological perspective, but also about its social relevance and its social use. I guess you could say the thing that drew me, if I could put words to it and explain it. I was a philosophy major at Morgan State University. I remember my freshman year, I was initially a communications major. I thought I was going to be Oprah Winfrey when I graduated. And there was something about the college experience my first semester that I just felt it was the first time me being away from home, where I can have solitude, where I can just think. And so I was beginning to really dig this thinking life. And so I thought, well, I just want to think. Maybe communications is not the thing I want to do. Let me become a philosophy major. And so I became a philosophy major without even taking a class because I just wanted to engage in a thinking life. And so when I put the two and two together, I just realized that I'm just a thinker. I like to think very deeply about particular issues and ask very unique questions. There's not necessarily imperial question, but there's questions that all of us have had since we were younger and questions that we still pose. And so I use philosophy as a kind of methodology to try to give kind of normative solutions. But also, I think more importantly, is allow us descriptively to look at things differently than we perhaps did before. And I'm hoping that through my books, people are able to look at anger differently and look at forgiveness differently.
And I want to just hone in on that point just a little bit longer. of learning about emotions in different social contexts. I read that you were an educator for the Fortune Society, which, quote, supports successful reentry from incarceration and promote alternatives to incarceration. I wonder, what did you learn about emotion from your work with this community and this organization?
Oh, this is interesting. I've never gotten this question about my past life, my past education life. So you've done some research. So it was fascinating. I mean, as kind of an African-American individual who grew up poor and grew up in poor neighborhoods, people who were incarcerated, that wasn't anything new for me. My father was constantly in and out of the jail system, and relatives and just people that I knew were incarcerated, formerly incarcerated. I visited prisons a lot of times, visiting loved ones. Before I took the job on, it was just a certain kind of conception that I had about people who were incarcerated. Just in my day-to-day life, they were never fully defined by what they'd done. When they came home, we embraced them as loved ones. And so when I originally took the job at the Fortune Society, which is a wonderful reentry program in Long Island City, New York, I did it just to educate young folk, regardless of who they were. And what I just discovered, as far as emotions are concerned, a lot of people are in situations that they're in because, and this is just a small aspect, but something that we should note, is just the inability to control their emotions, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've written about emotional regulation and all that good stuff. And sometimes we just find ourselves in a horrible situation because anger gets the best of us, or desperation gets the best of us, or sadness gets the best of us. But we're all privy to that. But I think it's more specifically what I learned, if you're going to think about emotions, I think I've learned empathy. I learned compassion. And I think those skill sets, if you don't have them, then you can live and navigate in the world as an arrogant person who is not really cognizant of one's own kind of dirt and mess. Although I have never been arrested, and so I haven't had that kind of similar experience that I had with my students. I recognize that, you know, as the Christian scripture says, that we all fall short of the glory of God. At any moment, I may find myself in the same situation. So extending compassion and empathy to people, no matter what they've done, is just important to navigate, because we're going to be in need of that empathy and compassion someday as well.
Absolutely. You know, one of the questions that I ask all of the guests that come on the show is to really think about a moment of vulnerability that you've experienced during your lifetime. And so I want to ask you, Maisha, tell me about a time during your career where you had a moment of self-doubt, but I also want you to tell our listeners a moment in which you had just sheer triumph.
A moment of self-doubt, if we're going to consider this professionally, was when I was applying to grad school. And I don't know how it is in other kind of disciplines, but usually for programs in philosophy, they're going to accept probably 5 a year. So there's a lot of applicants, but few people get in. I was very confident that applying to 20 schools, I will get into one of them. And I did not. I was very discouraged. As you indicated, I was doing a lot of nonprofit work and working in education and bringing philosophy to the people in the very different organizations that I work for. And this was after I had received a BA and a master's. And I was not yet ready to go into a PhD program. But then I got the research bug. I found my topic of interest. And so I was ready to go into a PhD program and teach full time. And I thought that just coming to that realization would be enough. I mean, that was a triumph within itself. But there was this thing that I needed to do, which was to get into graduate school. And without that, I could not do the thing that I thought I was called to do. And so it was very discouraging, because I just felt that if I don't get into a program, I can't do this thing. But I had people in my circle who encouraged me, who believed in me, who encouraged me to apply again. And I apply again. And I got into one school. Now, I just want to say that I'm still bitter about both of those situations. Your girl is bitter, but I use that as motivation. I only got into one, University of Illinois Chicago, which I got great love and respect. Without them, I would probably have to wait another year or would not have gotten into a program. I would not have had the career that I have. But it only takes one. And so I'm very fortunate in that regard. But that was a moment of self-doubt. So one might say, well, my triumph is getting in the second year. But I think one of the greatest triumph when I think about professional was publishing, I think. My quote-unquote first book was a collection of interviews that was based on my podcast that I started in graduate school. And I said I was a communications major. So there was this, you know, philosopher in me, but there's also this communicator in me. So I always wanted to be an author. I remember reaching out to one of the editors at Oxford. I hit her in her DMs on Twitter. I was like, listen, I want to put together a collection of interviews based on this podcast that I put together in graduate school that I still got going. And I remember her response to me was, I've been waiting for something like this. Send me a proposal. And I put the proposal together, and to see the book come out and see people benefit from the book. That first publishing opportunity for me in book form was probably one of my greatest triumphs. You know, I continue to have my ups and downs because academia is all about rejection. And then a victory comes. Mm-hmm. And then it reminds you that you are capable, that you are powerful, that you do have a future in this life.
And the victory is in this book, Failures of Forgiveness. I read this book and had so many revelations. I have told many people within my inner circle about this book and how to think about forgiveness. Before you started researching this book, how would you describe forgiveness?
Interesting question. In some ways, I don't think I would have been confident to tell you what forgiveness was. Now, here's the thing. I knew what people were telling me it was. So I grew up, I kind of echo this in the book. You know, I grew up in a Christian tradition, in a Black church. And so, you know, I remember the pastor telling us to forgive and seeing examples about the kind of forgiveness that was offered up. And in some ways, those situations were kind of problematic for me. Forgiveness was always relevant when it came to the wrongdoings of people in power in the church, or when it came to the wrongdoings of men, but necessarily when it came to women. So when a woman got pregnant, there was no forgiveness extended to her in the church. So I was hearing like these utterances and people telling me what it is. I was hearing even in the African-American tradition, how we got to let it go, let the past go, let the tragedies of slavery go, but not really realizing what does that really mean, letting it go. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I was hearing people tell me what it was, but really not being convinced either by their definitions or their examples of what it was. One of the things that inspired me to write the book was, you know, this is during the time in which there was high profile cases of police violence, police brutality against Black men and women. And at these press conferences with their family members, a reporter will always get up to ask, usually it's the woman, can you find it in your heart to forgive? And so I was hearing these questions being asked. And I was interested, not necessarily what I thought forgiveness was, but what in the hell do they mean by it? Mm. So I was just fascinated about why are they bringing up this topic? What do they take it to mean? What do they think it can do? And so I think I've had more questions than I think I had answers about forgiveness.
I want to go there about certain people needing to do it, because when I heard the title of the book, I immediately thought about moments in which African Americans displayed public forgiveness. And there are many examples in which we can point to. One that came to mind was of the loved ones of the Emmanuel 9 victims.
Yes.
And as you pointed out, and also noted in the book, that reporters would ask mothers of Black men killed by police officers about forgiveness. In all of these instances, the perpetrators are non-Black.
Yeah.
So talking about certain bodies having to eke out forgiveness, what's the relationship between race, racial violence, and forgiveness?
There's a lot there, right? So let's try to get at what we think they mean by forgiveness. In one sense, forgiveness could mean letting go of anger. In the other sense, it could mean kind of absolution from wrongdoing. Now, if we take those two definitions, then forgiveness can be used in a very kind of racialized context that will make it the case that, just to be very explicit, it can make it the case in which Negroes get in line and white people get a second chance over and over and over and over again. And so if forgiveness is about the letting go of anger, but one of the things that we know about anger is when Black people start protesting, then we're challenged, then we're exposed. And so if there is a racial wrongdoing, then, you know, we want to kind of bring up the topic of forgiveness so that we won't have the protests that may result. So we won't have this kind of realization of systemic wrongdoing. So in some way, it can be used to kind of quiet down the anger, which is to quiet down the reality of the racial wrongdoing. But I also think that underneath that, certain bodies are believed to be owed a certain kinds of forgiveness, right? Depending on, you know, how we conceive of them. The philosopher Kate Mann wrote a wonderful book called Down Girl, in which she tries to get what she calls kind of a logic of misogyny. And in that book, she coins the term empathy. And what she means by that is the overextension of empathy towards white men, right? In the sense that given that we hold white men above all others, that even when they commit egregious wrongdoings, such as rape, we overextend to them a kind of empathy, a kind of inapt kind of compassion to give them another chance. And a lot of that has to do with how we view their value, how we view their innocence, even when they're not so innocent. And that's very much racialized. You contrast that to the black male body. He ain't getting empathy. He's getting what we call black justice, right? Which is the underextension of any kind of empathy that is typically owed a human being. So even in these kind of moral concepts, such as forgiveness, or these kind of neutral concepts and attitudes, such as forgiveness, can be used, can be expected, can be asked from in a very social context that in some ways creates more wrongdoing in the world. Although it may not be a physical wrongdoing, it can be kind of a disrespect to the racial and racist assumptions about bodies.
Mm. In the book, you point to philosophers that have categorized different types of forgivers. Can you name some of them for our audience?
Let's go back to like the 1700s. Bishop Butler, who was a British moralist, his conception of what he took forgiveness to be was, listen, forgiveness, he said, is really about the decision not to engage in vengeance. Basically says, you know, it doesn't mean the eradication of anger. It just basically means that you've moderated that anger so much so that that anger didn't lead you to kind of pay back the person. I like his account. But there's other people. I mean, you go to kind of the ancients, Aristotle, Seneca, and other people who were inspired by them. For other philosophers, you know, forgiveness is about the letting go of anger, so much so that if there's any anger there, forget the moderation, if there's any anger there, then the person has not forgiven. Then you have other accounts where people say, well, it seems that you can have anger, and even if you let it go, if you continue to have hatred for the wrongdoer, then you fully haven't forgiven. Now, you'll notice that kind of the similarity between all these people is that, for one thing, in each of their accounts, forgiveness is always one thing, right? Mm-hmm. It is only the letting go of vengeance. It is only the letting go of anger. It is only the letting go of anger and hatred. And I just wasn't convinced by those accounts. In some ways, when I read them, and even when I heard them echo in the public domain, it seemed like, yeah, forgiveness could look like that in some instances, but not necessarily all instances. And so I just felt that it was time to rethink forgiveness.
And so just for our audience to understand what we are talking about. So in the book, you name these four types: anger eradicators, the anger moderators, the contempt eradicators, and the hatred eradicators. You posit, Maisha, that they're limited in their one view of how forgiveness is practiced. You believe that forgiveness should include ritualistic, behavioral, and emotional aspects. Can you just say more about this holistic approach to forgiveness?
I mentioned Bishop Butler. If you notice, for Butler, you know, his account was kind of behavioral, right? Mm-hmm. It was not about indulging in vengeance. But here's the thing. I think for a lot of people, I've been kind of challenged to forgive, and I did not ever have a desire to engage in any vengeance towards them. And so if I just live my life based on Bishop Butler's account, then I've forgiven everybody, right? Because I just don't do the vengeance. I got other things to do and other things to focus on. And so, yes, he does incorporate behavioral stuff, but that was never an option for me anyway. You know, more needs to be said. And so then you also have these other accounts, which I think for a lot of people, when they think about forgiveness, they're always thinking about emotions, right? So either I'm not hating a person, I'm not angry at the person, I don't have any contempt about the person. So they don't even think about forgiveness as behavioral. They think about it as affective, as an emotional kind of thing that you do. And there's been moments in which that just doesn't fit the bill for me, right? So I know for a lot of people, they don't feel anger. I mean, anger is not always the immediate response to wrongdoing or contempt or hatred, right? What I wanted to do was to try to provide an account that could kind of speak for everybody, to say that there's some situations in which I've had to let go of certain kinds of emotions or moderate certain kinds of emotions. But then there's other situations in which I've had to engage in certain kind of behaviors in order to forgive. And then there's other situations which we haven't talked about, kind of the ritualistic thing. And I think this is something that a lot of people do is that there's certain kinds of friends. We don't need to say nothing. As long as you give me the head nod, I know we good, right? As long as we shake on it, we hug on it, right? You text me with a joke, I know we good. Like that kind of relationship says that there's something, there's a kind of a habit, there's certain kinds of things that we do to make sure that we have forgiven each other. And so I think kind of what I call it is kind of like the broad view of forgiveness. Forgiveness is not one thing. Here's also something else important. I mean, we've been talking about what forgiveness is, but also people have a tendency to think that forgiveness only aims at one particular thing. People are just not interested in forgiveness for forgiveness' sake, right? It's a moral practice because they expect that it's going to do something. It's morally, it's going to affect an outcome. And usually what the outcome for a lot of people is reconciliation. And so a lot of people think that even if you letting go your anger and you haven't reconciled with a family member, then you have not forgiven. Even if you let go the contempt, but you have not reconciled with your sister, that you have not forgiven. Even if you haven't decided to engage in revenge, but yet you still have not reconciled with your coworker, you have not forgiven. I basically says, listen, forgiveness doesn't just aim at one thing. It could aim at reconciliation, right? But the reality is that's not how relationships end. That's not how relationships continue. That's not how people carry on, right? And so I want to say that forgiveness can aim at relief, in which I get some kind of affective relief as a result of forgiving the person. So this is usually the case when people say, you know, do it for you. Okay, I do it for me, but we're not good. We can't reconcile, right? So it can aim at relief. It can aim at a kind of release that one wants to release, kind of a hatred that one thinks is distracting them from living a day-to-day life and remembering their loved ones. So it can have a variety of aims. And I call these kind of reparative aims because what I believe forgiveness does, people always think that it ultimately aims for the repairing of the relationship. And I want to say, no, the wrongdoer doesn't get to always be in the final scene. That my forgiveness can lead to a repair of my own soul. It can lead to a repair of my psychology. It can even lead to a repair of my community, of my family, that has nothing to do with the wrongdoer. So I think my broad view is saying, hey, forgiveness can entail a variety of things, but it can also aim at a variety of things. And I think if we rethink forgiveness in this particular way, it's going to stop a lot of those press conference questions, but also it's going to have an impact on what we expect forgiveness to do and also what we should do in the aftermath of wrongdoing.
Is forgiveness interchangeable with grace, or is grace something else?
When I think about grace, I think about absolution.
Hmm.
And here's the thing about, I think, about forgiveness. Forgiveness is only relevant because you acknowledge that a wrongdoing has occurred. If you're going to talk about forgiveness, we cannot obscure the wrongdoing that has actually happened, right? But as long as there is a forgiveness, there is the residue. There's the afterlife of the wrongdoing that's always lurking, that always also should be attuned to. When it comes to grace, let's think about this in a religious concept. You know, grace is that thing that you don't deserve, that you get. And you keep getting, and you keep getting. And that's a wonderful thing that in the Christian tradition is what God extends. One might say, well, God extends it because God is just different from human beings and is not necessarily affected by the behavior of human beings and vulnerable to the behavior of human beings. And so I think grace is different in the sense that one might say that grace literally wipes the slate clean. One of the things I try to echo in the book is that, listen, we're going to talk about forgiveness, but we're also going to talk about the messiness of wrongdoing. And we're going to be real about what wrongdoing does to people, what it does to communities, what it does to families, what it does to our memories and our regrets. It stays with us. And so I don't paint a kind of perfect picture or a clean picture, even as I talk about forgiveness. As much as grace is about wiping the slate clean, I can forgive you. But that doesn't mean that everything is restored or repaired, right? There may be moments in which I live with the trauma of your wrongdoing. So the slate hasn't been wiped clean. Even in me forgiving you, we can't reconcile. And so you don't get a second chance because my life and my survival depends on me not giving you a second chance, right? Trust has not been restored. But grace is quite different than that. So there is a difference between those two things. I think the problem is a lot of people like to conflate the two.
Mm-hmm.
And they think that if you have forgiven, then you ought to act like someone who has extending grace, which is keep giving a person chance after chance after chance, forget the wrongdoing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's come back to your broad view of forgiveness and how it should be practice, is an apology necessary for forgiveness to take place?
It depends. So I think people may hear that and be discouraged, but I want to say you should be encouraged by that. And here's one reason. Say, for instance, the wrongdoer never has apologized to you, but you still want a kind of repair in your life. You want kind of the benefits of forgiveness. If apologies are necessary for forgiveness, then that means you cannot move on unless the wrongdoer apologizes. Now, here's my thing. The wrongdoer has done so much, has taken so much, has exerted a kind of power over you in their wrongdoing, that it would be real messed up that in the aftermath of wrongdoing, in an effort to recover, they still have a certain kind of power. And I want to reject that. And so that's one of the reasons why I say that apology is not necessary, but it depends. So it may be the case, it depends on your aim. So say, for instance, you know, we're friends, and I want to continue to be friends with you, but you done me wrong. And the way for us to continue to be friends, I need to know that you are a kind of person that can admit to wrongdoing. And I need to know that you're going to do better in the future. And there's nothing better than an apology to kind of verbalize that, right? So if you don't vocalize that, then it's just, it's the case that, unfortunately, we can't move on because that's what I need for us to go towards a certain kind of reconciliation. So it all depends on what your aims. There are some victims who basically say, hey, I don't want to reconcile. So I don't need an apology. Matter of fact, I don't even want to hear an apology. I mean, this is going to sound familiar to us. Remember Esau Gardner doing a press conference. And one of the reporters says, you know, would you forgive this police officer, whether he apologized or not? An apology was already offered. And I remember she basically said, and I love these words, hell nah, right? The moment that my husband needed an apology was when he had his hands around his neck. You know what I mean? So for a lot of people, it's like, they don't even want an apology. So it's not necessary, but it all depends on what your goals are.
Mm. I want to turn to self-forgiveness. You write in the book, quote, self-forgiveness does not mean the absence of regret.
That chapter that I have on self-forgiveness was hard to write because, you know, I'm being very passionate when I'm talking about other people, wrongdoers. And then when you start talking about, you know, yourself and what it is to forgive yourself, I mean, just things get a little bit more harder to articulate and to think about. My broad view of forgiveness applies to the self-forgiveness case as well. So there's no different account there that I could let go of the hatred that I have towards myself in order to repair myself, or I can let go of the contempt, or I can decide not to harm myself in order to get some kind of relief. So the definitions, the broad view that I have is going to apply in the self-forgiveness case. But here's the interesting thing, that usually when we are a victim and we're the recipient of somebody's wrongdoing, there's no regret there because we can't do nothing. But when it comes to self-forgiveness, we are the wrongdoer. So think about this. Mm. Like a victim, we are in the capacity to forgive ourselves. But unlike a victim, we have to deal with the fact that we have perpetuated wrongdoing, whether it is against a person or against ourselves, or both, because both can happen at the same time. And so you've just forgiven yourself for the thing that you've done to yourself or to someone else, but you still can't get over what you did to yourself, to someone else. And that's that regret that I'm talking about. And for a lot of people, they think, well, if I continue to have this regret, then it's just not possible that I have forgiven myself, right? Because if I've forgiven myself, then I shouldn't be living with any regrets, right? So hashtag no regrets, and people have it tattooed on their bodies. Those are people who have forgiven themselves and they have moved on. Well, that's a wonderful picture to paint, but that's not the real. The aftermath of wrongdoing is messy. And the thing about self-forgiveness is that even though you've done it, even though you've done it for the purposes of getting some kind of relief, release, reconciliation, or repair, there is something that you're going to have to live with, regret. Now, here's the thing. We all have the ability to live with it. For a lot of people, they have difficulties living with it. And so they, you know, engage in destructive behaviors, whether that's to themselves or to others, because they can't live with the regret, right? I call regret kind of these intrusive memories that bring a kind of memory of what you've done, but also the pain again. And they can come at any moment. You could be at the movies. You could be reading a book. You could be playing video games and you remember what you did and it hurts, right? And what you got to do is learn from it. That's the moral lesson. The moral lesson is I got to do better. I think it's possible for us to live with ourselves again, but that's the challenge, is to live with regret. And you can still forgive yourself, but that's what philosophers call kind of a moral remainder, even though we've done all we could to recover. Regret is going to remain, but we can live with it. And the challenge is learning how to live with it.
I want to expand this conversation out into politics. You discuss, and you have a chapter on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission as forgiveness through a political project. What lessons can we learn from city councils and states embarking on reparations?
So I want to say that when I think about South Africa, you think about the challenge that was with them, that continues to be with them, is how do you create a new democratic South Africa? And the democratic, as much as it is an idea, I mean, it's an important idea to kind of examine here. So it's not just a new South Africa, it's a new democratic South Africa. And what that entails is that from a democratic standpoint, we're no longer doing this kind of racial caste system in which some lives matter more than others, or some people get rights and some others, or some voices are counted and not some others, right? But a new democratic South Africa. And for them, there were certain ways in which they thought it was relevant to begin the process, because that's also important to begin the process. So in the context of South Africa, truth-telling was important. So we think about the lot of violence, the political violence that happened during apartheid, was trying to figure out, you know, telling the truth about what happened, human rights violations, and trying to get some justice. There was also an amnesty, going back to that justice standpoint, but the amnesty was also based on truth-telling. But there was also a reparations committee, and this was kind of responsible for restoring things that was unjustly stolen from a lot of Black South Africans. Now, what we know about South Africa and kind of what is in people's consciousness even today, for me, I remember watching it, say this in the book, watching it on my CRT TV and watching the human rights violation hearings, right? These women crying, you know, expressing their sadness about their loved ones and also expressing their forgiveness. I remember that. I don't remember much about the reparations piece. That was part of the process. But one might say, and this is what a lot of scholars have concluded, that part failed. I mean, we go to South Africa today, which I've gone several times, there is intense socioeconomic inequality. And that accounts for like a lot of violence as a result of that. But there's this extreme economic inequality that exists there. And I want to say it could be the case, not necessarily reparations, but the project of reparations just wasn't a project that they were fully committed to, and it didn't really work out well. But it was indeed part of that building up a new democratic South Africa, but a part in which I'm not alone in saying this, it failed. But when I think about a political project of reconciliation, I still think that South Africa can be a model, because I think what they show for us is that as much as they use forgiveness rhetoric as a tool, as a way to get us towards reconciliation, for them, what was also important was truth-telling. What was also important was justice. What was also important was trying some reparations. Was also important was kind of restoring voting power, allowing a full democracy to occur. And I think what we can learn from that is making things better, it's not just going to take one element or one ingredient. It's going to take a variety of ingredients to make things better. And so when I think about applying that to United States context, I want us to be very careful, because I think for the United States, we always think that there's just one thing that we need to do. And I think South Africa teaches us there's a variety of things that we need to do. And when we fail at one, we need to do better. As reparations has become kind of a topic recently, with several, as you kind of pointed out, localities trying some experiments in that regard, I think it's important that it's not just going to take one aspect to really create a better kind of equal and just nation, but it's going to create a variety of endeavors, whether that's reparations, whether that's truth telling, which I think America, we just don't like to tell the truth about ourselves. We're in the age of misinformation, fake news. You're a historian, so you know there's certain things you can't teach. People getting fired, presidents getting fired, and they're taking it as kind of like a triumph against critical race theory. Like, we can't even admit what happened 2 years ago on January the 6th. And so you can bring all the reparations you want, but if people are getting in the way of truth telling and getting in the way of justice, we really can't create the nation that we have hopes or ideas to create. So I want to pat those experiments on the back, but there's so much more to do, and we shouldn't neglect those other aspects. And I think South Africa shows us that we need to attend to a variety of endeavors in order to create a better nation.
I wonder if the way that the U.S. is undergoing their reparations project is that it is a form of a political project, or in this case, political forgiveness. But I wonder if it also is social forgiveness, historical forgiveness, economic forgiveness. I want to point this out because language is really important in how we name and define things. Do you think part of the issue is that we are solely thinking of it as a political project?
There's philosophers who are really thinking deeply about reparations in ways that I haven't. But I want to try to say something here, because I think as much as we're dealing with money, I think reparations is kind of economic justice. And I think if you're thinking about political projects of kind of reconciliation, right, what does that mean? Is that, listen, a large part of the populace are divided. There's animosity. There's not cooperation and agreement and consensus. So how can we restore, bring these people together? And how can we not only make the nation whole, but make the individuals whole that was once disregarded or victims of certain kinds of things? If we think about racial injustice, there's a racial wealth gap that exists today based on decades and decades and centuries of racial inequality and economic injustice. Right? Whether that's redlining, whether that's not getting GI bills like white former military, whether that's certain kinds of things written in deeds about not selling to Black folk. It's embedded in racial injustice has been kind of this economic aspect. When I think about restoring or making things right, and that would never be perfectly, by the way, you got to account for the economic stuff. But it's not just enough to make people economically whole. I mean, one of the things that we know about celebrity TV is that people can be wealthy and there still can be disagreements there. So I think to make people whole, I mean, it's, and it goes to go back to the truth telling thing that I'm saying. American Gig can give Black folks $10 million a day. But if they continue to tell lies about what happened in the past, that's not making the nation whole. And so when I think about a political project of reconciliation, there's different components to it, and there should be. And here's also a thing, and I think this may be something kind of embedded in your question as well, is that even if those things are done, right, whether that's, you know, kind of reparations, restoring back to people of things that were stolen and truth-telling, does that then say or give sufficient reasons for Black folks to then say, I forgive the United States? Here's my thing. South Africa thought, or at least leaders in South Africa, particularly Desmond Tutu, that there's no reconciliation without forgiveness. I want to say that's not necessarily the case, because I think when we change what we take forgiveness to be, when we also understand that forgiveness is a moral concept, but there's also other moral concepts and moral tools, that even absent of forgiveness, I can use other kind of moral tools and we can still live together side by side. I want to say that even if America and these, you know, local communities continue to do all that, I think the harm is we've done all that. Now you should forgive is a wrong move to make. But I want to say that that would give African-Americans reasons to forgive, but not a duty to forgive. And I think America has a lot of work to do to give us reasons. But what we decide to do with those reasons is our business.
So before you go, tell me what you are currently working on.
So I'm currently working on a book on love. And so I'm very excited about continuing writing today. I'm working on a chapter on self-love. I've been in the weeds with bell hooks and Audre Lorde and Angela Davis and Alice Walker, and just trying to get some wisdom from them about what they can teach us about self-love. I don't know nothing about love. I told you, I don't know nothing about these emotions. And I think the book writing process is, oh my God, it's a humbling process that I go into, in which I just try to get wisdom from those who become before me, asking the universe to give me as much focus and insight so that I can speak to us today. And that's basically what the book is about. In the spirit of James Baldwin, love each other better and perhaps create a better world as a result.
I love that your next book is on love, particularly since this book was on forgiveness and your previous book was on anger.
Yes.
I love that.
I call it the trilogy because, you know, when I was giving talks about anger, I'll always get this question. So what about love?
Mm.
Then I was writing a book on forgiveness and I was like, it's okay to withhold forgiveness. And then people were saying about, but can you still love people? So the love thing has been like, okay, love just been coming up. And so it's now time for me to focus on it.
That's great. I can't wait for that to come out. You have to come back on the show when that book is in the world. But for now, people, you can pick up Failures of Forgiveness. I've been talking to Maisha Cherry. She is the author of Failures of Forgiveness, What We Get Wrong and How to Do Better, published by Princeton University Press. Maisha, thank you so much for being on the show. I really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.